ranked one of America's top research universities, the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee plays a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin. UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and world-class research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Meet the people behind the creativity and discoveries on UWM today. Here's the host, Tom Lujack, Vice Chancellor of University Relations.
For people under the age of 46, the most likely cause of death is trauma. In addition to the tremendous personal loss that results from trauma, the financial costs to society are staggering. Nearly $750 billion spent each year because of the healthcare cost and lost productivity tied to trauma. This summer, UW-Milwaukee is sponsoring a conference that will focus on the causes and solutions to the problems that result from traumatic experiences. On this edition of UWM Today, we meet two of the people responsible for this important gathering, Joshua Mirsky and Dmitry Topitsis. They are both co-founders of the Institute for Child and Family Well-Being at UWM, and both are associate professors of social work in the Helen Bader School of Social Welfare. Welcome to both of you, gentlemen. Good to have you on today's show.
Thanks so much.
Nice to be here.
Dmitry, let's begin with you. Yeah. Let's define trauma, because it can mean different things to different people.
That's right. So I'm going to reference an inclusive definition of trauma that's been advanced by the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Service Administration, a federal agency that does a lot and has been doing a lot of great work in the area of psychological trauma for well over a decade now. And their inclusive and readily accepted definition of trauma is something along the lines of the following. A traumatic event is one that is either an event in and of itself, a number or a series of events, or even a set of conditions that a child or adult experiences as being overwhelming and ultimately as being consequential, meaning that it can have negative effects in a number of different areas of functioning or development, including physical, mental, emotional, social, etc. So it's a very inclusive definition. The reason that many of us like that definition, including Josh and myself, is it for several reasons. One, it acknowledges that trauma oftentimes clusters. It comes in waves, if you will, particularly for more vulnerable populations, children, socioeconomically disadvantaged adults, women in intimate partner violence relationships. So trauma can emerge or manifest as a series of events and not just a one-time experience.
And so does that mean when you have that compounding that it's a more – has greater impact, greater negative impact than perhaps just one traumatic experience?
Absolutely. The research is very clear on this matter that as these types of aversive or traumatic experiences compound or pile up or accumulate, then the probability that they will overwhelm one's coping abilities and undermine one's functional abilities really increases over time. So not only can trauma be a series of events according to this definition, but it can even be a set of conditions like, for instance, poverty that children sometimes can be raised in that ultimately can undermine their developmental trajectories. Or for instance, like growing up in a household where mental health or substance abuse problems persist. So this tends to be a definition that is inclusive in terms of the potential traumatic events or experiences themselves. It also tends to be somewhat inclusive in that it recognizes that traumatic events are experienced individually and subjectively. So what I may experience as traumatic in nature, Joshua may not experience that very event as being traumatic in nature. And that's why the terminology, an event, series or events, or set of conditions that are experienced as, in other words, that person has to experience those conditions or events as overwhelming and quite problematic.
Joshua, Dmitry was talking about the fact that these traumatic experiences can be emotional, they can be physical. Let's talk about the physical. Sometimes bad things happen. You get in a car accident or there's a fire mm-hmm. where there is not necessarily anyone who meant to cause harm, but mm-hmm. but harm happens.
Right.
Is that trauma that you study also?
It is to a degree. So what you're alluding to actually, Tom, that's interesting, is a distinction that's sometimes made in the trauma literature between type 1 and type 2 traumas, or what sometimes referred to as simple versus complex traumas. Something like a car accident or, say, exposure to a natural disaster of some kind is what we would are examples of type 1 or simple traumas, singular events that can be very profound, disturbing, and that can have significant consequences. And there's a great deal of literature that's looked at the effects of those kinds of events. What Dimitri and I tend to gravitate more toward in our work is actually type 2 trauma, however, or complex trauma. And this is what Dimitri was referencing before when he talked about conditions and series of events that tend to be chronic, persistent, and cumulative in nature. And what's interesting about the literature is that while certainly the effects of a car accident or a natural disaster can be significant, profound, and long-lasting, what the research would tell us is that all else equal, conditions that are more chronic, long-lasting, that pile up, and also that begin early in the life course that are experienced during childhood tend to have even more significant deleterious effects over the life course.
Are there instances where that type 1 trauma, that incident that happens where things go bad on the highway or in a physical environment, where that conflicts or crosses over into that second type of trauma where, for example, you've got something that happened to you in the past and you didn't think about it a lot, but if you're laid up in a hospital bed, mm-hmm. it all comes rushing back. Do you ever have that confluence of experiences and the problems essentially erupting as a result of a trigger point?
Sure. I'll just say briefly that the exposure to prior traumatic events can influence one's reaction to subsequent traumatic events, right? So prior trauma can have a catalytic effect, right, and influence how one reacts and one's perception of events that happened subsequent to their previous traumas. Dimitri, you might have some.
Yeah. So it's a great question, Tom, and it speaks to the factors that will predict whether or not I'm going to recover from exposure to a traumatic event, or whether I'm going to be resilient to exposure to a traumatic event. And one of the most critical factors that will determine whether or not I will be resilient to even a type 1 trauma is whether or not I've been exposed to a number of traumatic incidents previous to this current incident. There are other important factors, however. So, of course, the one primary factor is, well, what is sort of my profile relative to cumulative risk pileup or relative to the cumulative experience of trauma? That might be one of the probably number one predictor of my resilience to trauma. But other predictors include factors such as, what does my social network look like? Do I have a rich and supportive social network? If I do, then I'm going to tend to be resilient to type 1 trauma. However, if I don't, then the probability that I'll have some difficulty recovering from this incident is much, much increased. The nature of the trauma matters as well. If the car accident was, relatively mild to moderate, however we define that, and we can sort of identify certain dimensions of traumatic events like car accidents. In other words, was there injury involved? If there wasn't, and there wasn't a great deal of damage involved, and I could even see it coming before it happened, then I may not react to it as severely. If, on the other hand, the car accident was unexpected, there was injury and there was damage involved, then I might have a more difficult time responding to that event. And the last thing that I would share is that, as Josh mentioned, if I don't have exposure to previous traumatic events, there's actually a greater than a 50-50 chance that I'm going to be resilient to or recover from this traumatic incident if it's just this one-time traumatic incident. So we tend to be, as a species, resilient to these significant, even violent traumatic events. We have built within us these resilient processes that really help us bounce back from these incidents, even to the point where I can use this incident as a catalyst or stimulus for growth. That's why we tend to be interested as social work scholars in this type 2 trauma, trauma that tends to accumulate over time and particularly can emerge in childhood and really overwhelm one's ability to cope, to respond, and ultimately to recover.
Joshua, Dimitri just mentioned childhood. Is there anything that parents can do to prepare their kids to be resilient, to be able to bounce back, pick themselves up, dust themselves off when bad things happen to them?
It's a great question. So the resilience literature would tell us that one thing that, and this is building on Dimitri's previous comment, which is that resilience is a normative process. Mm-hmm. It is not a trait that some children possess and other children do not. It is something that we all possess to varying degrees, and the extent to which we are able to bounce back from challenges in our life is in part influenced by our social context. So yes, there's a lot that parents can do. In fact, parents are what we would consider to be the number one protective factor for children. They are the first line of insulation, if you will, against assaults to their development. So in terms of specific things they can do, you know, we like to distinguish between factors that are promotive and factors that are protective. And I don't want to get too much in the weeds of the science of things. But promotive factors are things that are just generally good for all children. Something, say, like parental monitoring. Well, parental monitoring is just good for all children, regardless of whether a child has been exposed to risk or trauma or what have you. But protective factors are actually something that are a little bit more special. They are factors or processes in our environment that are particularly salient or particularly important for children that have been exposed to risk, right? So they confer these special benefits to children who, say, for example, have experienced trauma. I'll give you an example, and it's a fairly simple one, but one that I like to use in my classes, if I may. A grandparent. Now, I had grandparents in my life who were very good to me, and I like to point out, like, I had one special grandmom who took me to Disney World and took me to my first movie, in fact, and I had a wonderful relationship with her.
Yeah, she spoiled you.
Right, exactly right, as grandparents should. And I don't want this to come off sounding the wrong way. As much as I loved her and as much as she loved me, I can't say to you with a straight face today that I wouldn't be sitting in this room today if it weren't for my grandmom. Why? Because I had two parents in my life that cared about me, that were supportive of me. I had sufficient socioeconomic means. I had access to decent education, et cetera. I had all kinds of other supports in my system such that she didn't represent a protective factor to me. But the child who grows up in a community where there's lots of violence, who may have one or more than one parent who is out of their lives for one reason or another, and who may have be exposed to any number of other adverse childhood experiences, a grandparent could be that lifeline. That grandparent could be the difference between them expressing resilience and achieving great things in their life or not.
And someone who doesn't have anyone to provide that support, they're the ones perhaps most at risk to not be able to bounce back when things go bad.
That's absolutely right. So not only then are they more at risk for exposure because they don't have adults monitoring and protecting them, but they're also at risk then for being unable to actually bounce back from exposure to traumatic events because, they don't have adults then to usher them through that recovery process, if you will.
You're listening to UWM Today here on WUWM. So good to have you with us this week. I'm Tom Lujack, and joining us in the studio, two associate professors of social work at UWM, Dimitri Topitsis and Joshua Mirsky. Both of them are co-founders of the Institute for Child and Family Well-Being at UWM and also sponsors of a conference coming up on June 20th right on the UWM campus. Let's talk about that conference a little bit because it's an opportunity for people who may be working with victims, people who are teachers, perhaps people who just want to learn more about how to create a better community where we can help those who go through trauma to pick up some skills. Dimitri, what's going to be the focus of the conference?
Great question, Tom. So the conference is titled Trauma in Our Community, held on the UWM campus on June 20th. And you hit the nail on the head when you identified solutions potentially as the focus of the conference. So the term trauma-informed care has really gained ascendancy in our service communities and even in our community at large. So we recognize that trauma is a widespread phenomenon, that it affects our communities and tends to actually concentrate in our disadvantaged communities, communities that are socially and economically disadvantaged. So those of us who work in the field of social or human services, mental health or behavioral health service delivery, even healthcare, have been discussing this notion of trauma-informed care for well over 10 years now, almost two decades, frankly. And we've been trying to identify the parameters of this construct. How do we define trauma? How do we consider, how do we conceptualize the best approaches to preventing or resolving trauma? And we've created very good frameworks for understanding the work that we're doing, for directing the work that we're doing. We've developed very good insights into the scope of the problem, the consequences of the problem, and really now I would argue that the vanguard or the cutting edge of this area of practice and research or scholarship is now to better understand how do we actually resolve the effects of trauma amongst children, families, adults, and even communities. So we have some practice principles, but now we're really starting to unearth what are the best practice elements, really concrete practice elements that will inform our service systems help us to enhance our effectiveness when working with children, families, or adults who've been exposed to not that one-time trauma that Josh identified earlier, but instead this complex type 2 multiple traumas.
Talking about preventing trauma or helping people to get past the trauma that already has occurred?
It's a great question. Both and, right? So I think the bulk of the attention to this point has really focused on how to intervene with individuals, families, and groups who have been exposed to trauma, and that work has its place and is exceedingly important. I think increasingly we're moving further upstream to think more about how can we arrange society? How can we design our communities structurally in ways that can prevent trauma and other forms of adversity from occurring to begin with?
At the conference, how are you going to go about tackling such a big topic in about 8 hours or so?
It's a great question. What we're going to try
to do— Are people going to walk out with a toolkit, do you think?
Well, I think that's a little too much to ask for a one-day event, but I think people are going to walk out with innovative ideas about how to address trauma amongst the client populations that they serve and perhaps even prevent additional trauma from complicating the work that they have to conduct and complicating the lives of those that they work with. So we have a number of different local presenters who are going to showcase and highlight innovative work in the area of trauma-informed care, trauma counseling, and trauma resolution work. I can highlight a few. Josh and I are going to talk about a few of the initiatives that we've headed here in Milwaukee that primarily target children and families who've been exposed to a good deal of trauma and are being served by public systems such as the child welfare system or home visiting system. There are other exceptional presenters such as Christine Larson, also an associate professor at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee in the psychology department. She is going to translate neuroscience into clinical insight. So in other words, what do we know about the neurobiology of trauma and its effects, and how can that inform clinicians, mental health practitioners who work with trauma-affected children, families, and adults. A number of other local presenters, including Terry Darun Cassini, who does exceptional trauma resolution work at the Medical College of Wisconsin at Frederick Hospital, working with patients who've been exposed to traumatic injury and helping them overcome not just the physical effects of their injury, but the psychological effects of their injury as well.
We live in a big metropolitan area, 1 million-plus people here in southeastern Wisconsin. With that concentration of people, you have more problems when you have more people around. Does that mean that you're more likely to be victimized by trauma living in a large urban area, or is someone living out in the rural areas just as vulnerable to trauma as someone who might be in a neighborhood where you hear gunshots in the middle of the night?
Right. Excellent question. The simplest answer is yes. So in terms of whether someone in a rural area or an urban area, there is a lot of evidence to suggest that actually the rates are quite high in both. For example, we have collected data from women, low-income women who receive home visiting services. These are services that are designed to help promote maternal and child health in women who are pregnant or who recently gave birth. We have statewide data on thousands of women who have received these services, and our data suggests that rates, while high in Milwaukee and other urban centers in Wisconsin, they are equally as high, if not higher, in our rural communities.
That's surprising, because you have this, I do anyway, this mental image of bucolic rural life. Mm-hmm. You know, it's easygoing, small towns, but not necessarily as pretty underneath the surface as we might like to imagine.
Right. And it does come back to definitions, right? So if we define trauma by, say, your likelihood of being exposed to gun violence and narrowly, then perhaps that might be true. But if we, say, expand it out and think about, as Dimitri suggested before, what about exposure to substance use in the household, intimate partner violence, mental health challenges, et cetera. Once we begin to think about trauma writ large, think about trauma as a broader concept, we begin to see that trauma is actually quite prevalent throughout most reaches of our society, but it's particularly concentrated among economically disadvantaged populations.
If I'm a listener and hearing this program right now, begin thinking about my own life and the people in my life. And if I recognize that there's someone who's having a tough time because they have been through some tough times, what should I be doing? I mean, you know, is there a place for me at your conference? And we're going to give all the details about when and where in a moment. But, you know, can I do anything to help someone even though I'm not a professional?
That's a great question, Tom. I'll invoke colleagues of ours, Carmen Petrie from Sojourner Family Truth Center and Terry Strada from the Alma Center. They're also going to be presenting at the conference on what they have termed healing-informed care. They work with women and men involved in intimate partner violence to ultimately resolve the effects of violence in these adults' lives, as well as to prevent ongoing exposure to violence. And healing to trauma or recovery from trauma or post-traumatic growth, what it entails first and foremost, and I mentioned this earlier, is a rich engagement with a meaningful social connection. So what I would argue is that if a friend of mine is going through a hard time and I have the resources, the mental space, the energy, et cetera, to be the true friend that I am. And to me, what that simply means is that I have a listening ear to give. Then that's the time to give it. Sometimes we can recoil from difficulties that other people are experiencing because they might remind us of our own vulnerabilities.
Or we may not want to intrude.
That might be true as well. And I think that that's a fair impulse. But invariably, the greatest predictor of recovery from trauma is social support. So if I'm a friend, a family member, and I know that someone is in the midst of recovery from trauma, then I would argue that the best thing that I could do is to strengthen my intimacy, mm-hmm. To make myself even more available mm-hmm. to that person.
And that support need not necessarily focus on trauma. Mm. Right, simply being a good social support for someone is beneficial.
So you may not have to be an expert in counseling, but just being there to provide an ear might get that person to perhaps considering going to a person like you, someone who could provide counseling and more professional or specialized care.
Very, very true. One of my heroes in the world of social services is a man by the name of Father Gregory Boyle. Works with gangs interested in desisting from criminal or gang life, and he argues that if I have a pulse, I can be helpful mm-hmm. simply by offering a listening ear. And also, you know, it's helpful to know that the vast majority of individuals exposed to trauma, particularly one-time trauma, are going to do fine with their natural supports. Mm-hmm. If I tend to fall in the category of those who is going to have trouble, is going to come up against a number of barriers in my recovery, then yes, it makes sense to refer that person to a mental health practitioner. But just by being a good friend, I very well could be a part of someone's natural healing process.
Well, I told the listeners we would tell them about the details of the conference. Let's give it to them now. It's Wednesday, June 20th.
Right. It's the June 20th on the UWM campus. It lasts it's essentially the entire day. I believe lunch is provided on the site itself, which I know is a very important feature. And again, we're going to primarily focus on defining trauma, reflecting on its consequences, its implications, but then even more so, identifying local solutions to the problem mm-hmm. of complex trauma in our community.
And so if they would like to get more information or register, where do they go?
I would recommend that they access the UW-Milwaukee website and simply in the search engine enter trauma in our community, and they will be navigated to the registration page.
So that's UWM.edu, and then hit the search button and go to trauma in our community, and you'll connect both mm-hmm. with Dimitri and with Joshua. Gentlemen, thank you so much. Fascinating conversation. Good luck on the conference, and look forward to continuing this conversation. Certainly, as I mentioned, in a big community like ours, there are so many challenges on this front. There's a lot to talk about, and we'll have you back on to continue the conversation.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Thanks, Tom.
Dimitri Topitzis and Joshua Mirsky, our guest on this edition of UWM Today. Both Joshua and Dimitri are associate professors of social work at the Helen Bader School of Social Welfare and co-founders of the Institute for Child and Family Well-Being. That's all for this week's program. Thanks so much for taking some time out of your day to listen to the wonderful thoughts and remarks and work of the great researchers at UWM. If you'd like to learn more, feel free to check out our website, UWM Today website. Just go to wuwm.com/UWM Today, and we've got a list of all of our past programs. You can download them or listen right on the spot. Take care, everybody. Have a great day. I'm Tom Lujack.
You've been listening to UWM Today with host Tom Lujack, the weekly program where you get to meet the people behind one of America's top research universities, University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Playing a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin, UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and world-class research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Learn more at uwm.edu.